This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The marvelous Mrs. Maisel boys. The marvelous Mrs. Maisel boys.
Welcome to the marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
So if you're Amy and I'm Dan, you say anything funny and kind of mean, and I just go, yay, poop. What?
Oh, man. Dan is just soft. Like, the Dan is such a sweet summer child. The way you portray him, he's like Lenny. Not Lenny Lenny from Muffin Men.
No, Alice, I believe this was you in season two or three of this show that said, that kind of calcified your impression of Daniel as being the guy who goes, yay, anytime he gets right. to write a script.
Right.
I think that was you.
Every woman needs her yay, man. You know, we had Elizabeth Taylor had her Michael Jackson.
Yes, Elizabeth Taylor.
That's a really different relationship.
Mm-hmm. Well, welcome to the marvelous Mrs. Maisel, boys. I am Kevin T. Porter.
And I'm Alice Wetterland. And we're...
And we are the Maisel boys. Back at it again. Nothing could keep us apart. Not a pandemic. Not a over 2 year break in between seasons.
Right.
Nothing. Not production in Canada for Alice's television show. She's currently shooting on Resident Alien on Sci-Fi, wherever you get your TV shows.
I'm shooting it wherever you get your shows.
She'll go there. She doesn't care.
Oh my God. And we will. So next week we're going to Ladysmith, and it's a wonderful place to be. The town
so fun.
Is cute, and they're fans of us in the town, and I really like that. I love fans. People who just love my work. I love them.
She loves the fans. Alice, do you realize our relationship is so defined by
your fandom?
Me just kind of watching you. Yeah, by my fandom.
Yeah.
I stand for a long time, even before we met. I think I did see you do stand up before we met.
I would hope so. Yeah. Fucking famous, bitch.
Okay. Hey, let's not get carried away. Hey, you weren't an Amazon Prime special haver at the time I met you, all right?
So it wasn't.
And thank you for helping me get there.
You're welcome.
Are you watching my show, Resident Alien?
Yeah, I think it's great.
Oh. I don't like it. Okay, what was
really
it?
Good.
You thought 203 was too woke and PC.
Yeah, I thought it was a little too... Wait, is that the common criticism of one of the episodes?
Somebody found out that on IMDb there was like a bunch of... Like that people had review bombed us. Because we have had an episode that mentioned the gender pay gap and a bunch of men's rights activists. But like... review bombed IMDb and Rotten Tomatoes.
With the idea being what? Like, don't mention the pay gap?
The whole episode is like girl power. That's how the episode is, sort of. It's like very like, okay. It's like a fun, girls just want to have fun, bridesmaids, girl power thing. And obviously, very fun episode to shoot. We all think it's funny as fuck and we like it. And then all these guys are like, fucking, no, everything's got to be woke now. Everything's gotta be woke. And like somebody in production knows people at IMDb and they found out that like somebody just created like 17 accounts.
That's so awesome. So it's probably just one mad guy.
So our reviews got went way down for IMDb.
Well, thankfully there is, you know, for those gentlemen that do think everything's got to be woke now, guess what? It does it. You can watch Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
Exactly.
You'll be fine.
There's so many shows.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Peak TV. John Landgraf at FX, the chairman of FX or whatever the hell he is. He does.
Amy, she'll be like, nah. No, we don't want to do that. No.
We don't need to do that. It's fine. It's fine.
Don't you think we should be more inclusive? She's like, don't fucking say that to me.
Yeah. No. That is the attitude. So it's Marvelous Mrs. Maisel season 4. It's Maisel Goy season 4. We're back at it. We're covering 401 and 402 in the style of the way they are releasing the episodes this season. They're going much like Noah's Ark. And, you know, all those little animals are going 2x2.
Classic.
Coming off the Amazon Prime arc that Daddy Bezos, Noah himself, is commandeering.
Classic and, Bible reference with Kevin T. Porter.
Sorry. I gotta be me, which is also, you know, Midge Maisel's whole MO in these two episodes is I gotta be me. That's kind of the revelation she comes up.
I got to be me, amen.
Yeah, so Alice did, in fact, find a pedal with some effects on it that she can maybe be using throughout the podcast, kind of combining an Alice Wetterlin aesthetic and a Reggie Watts aesthetic at same time. Reggie Watts, famously the only person to ever use a pedal in the history of recorded music.
Yeah, how bitter is DJ Doug Pound? Okay.
Alice, can we catch up on the state of things since the last time that we recorded?
Yes, absolutely. We should do that. Hold on.
Well, you got to remember what the state of things are.
The state
of things with Kevin T. Porter and Alice Wetterlund.
What's the music? Is that music you wrote?
That's, yeah, of course it is. 100%. So last time we were together, this podcast, this Maisel, mm-hmm. there was no mm-hmm. COVID. I mean, it was in a lab, you know, they were making
it. Well, there was COVID, but it was underground. It wasn't popular yet. COVID at the time that we last recorded and saw each other was like Melissa McCarthy on Gilmore Girls.
Exactly.
She existed, but who knew of her?
And I knew.
Hardly anyone.
I said COVID's going to be the new thing, you know, but people made fun of me.
And now COVID is Melissa McCarthy post-Bridesmaids.
Huge, yeah. And people are trying to find a way to get rid of her. couldn't not say, I love Melissa McCarthy. You set me up for that joke, which is actually mean to me.
Well, unfortunately, I would make the argument that if people check out her filmography and all the movies she's made in the last 7 years, Ben Falcone, her husband, might be a vaccine that's trying to end her. It would feel given the sort of partnership there.
But that's sweet. I like that they're in love.
They're in love and it's sweet and... You know, couples collaborating on things together, people who are in love, I'm all for it. I just don't need to watch it every time it happens.
Yeah.
But the last time we recorded, it was February 15th, 2020. It was almost 2 years ago to the day. We're recording this on February the 23rd.
Oh my God. That's why you wanted to record on the 5th. Oh, okay. That makes sense. Kevin wanted to record on the 15th and he said, come to this location and follow the trail of rose petals. And I was like, I can't, I'm out of town.
I said, it's really important to me. I'm still going to put the rose petals down regardless. But here we are. And we made it anyway. And I remember that season 3 being so odd because I remember we recorded a bunch because I went out of town at the end of February. Mm-hmm. And then February to March, when I got back into town, it was like, all right, lockdown's on, baby. Let's go.
Oh my God.
And, it was very odd. I remember our finale was with special guest Taylor Tomlinson for 308. And that was such a fun season to do. And now here we are. We're doing it over Zoom this time. And we're kind of figuring out each other's rhythms and learning
each other's. Yeah, our rhythms. Not like we don't FaceTime.
We FaceTime. How many times do we FaceTime during the pandemic?
Well, but more than some other friends of mine. That's not true. It's been more than once.
Oh, it was twice. It was twice.
At least.
Okay. That's nice. Yeah. I guess some people have FaceTime zero times with their friends.
So yeah, because you see them in person because they matter. Mm-hmm. Just kidding. You didn't get that one. I need a sound effect for when a joke flies by you. Hold on.
How about just a gust of wind? Just
car screeching?
Sure. Yeah, that works.
Sure. All right.
So the last time Maisel was on the air was December 2019. It's been 3 calendar years since this show has been on, even though it's only been a little over 2 years.
That's wild to me.
Isn't that wacky?
Wild.
But this is kind of what TV is now, not only with like pandemic interrupted production, but it just feels as if now the breaks between seasons are just going to be about a year, year and a half, 2 years. Or in the case of Curb or Always Sunny, they're just going to take 9 years off sometimes and come back. You know what I mean? Like, that's how TV works now.
And it works in a way where we get paid as if we were working all the time. But we're not.
That's right. Well, that's the kind of magic trick move you see with shows like Ozark, which Ozark is like season 4, part 1 and 2. And the reason they do that is so they don't have to give Bateman and Laura Linney and Julia Garner huge pay bumps for season 5. Sci-Fi actually used to do that with Battlestar Galactica. Your employer used to do that with shows
like
that.
They're like, we invented this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. AMC did it with Breaking Bad, I think. I think they did.
All right, there's precedence. We get it.
There's precedence, and there's precedence as well. No, you're certainly not the first, but you won't be the last. And isn't that nice to think
about? No, it's not. It sucks. It's really bad to do to your employees.
So that being said, the show resumed production during COVID pre-vaccine. So I believe near the end of 2020, they got the band back together, Amy, Dan, and they shot entirely in New York for this season. Mm-hmm. They had plans to apparently go overseas and go to London or do whatever the fuck, and they put a pin in it, according to ASP. They wanted to do that stuff, but they instead, quote unquote, dug into New York City. You can read this interview with them in Deadline that they put out last week, talking about all the reasons they're doing what they're doing and the kind of rationale behind them doing weekly versus all at once release.
Right.
Which I think I'm always going to be in favor of a week by week.
Yeah.
I think it is. And I think it's a better way to parse shows. I don't think hardly any show is helped by an all-at-once binge, unless the show is wildly mediocre.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's forgiving of mediocre shows, but then it's unforgiving of shows that are worth savoring. Like, imagine if something like Succession came out 10 episodes at the same time.
Right.
It wouldn't be nearly
We'd see how mediocre it is.
Yeah, we would finally see how mediocre Succession is.
Love is Blind, for instance, came out pretty much all at once.
Yeah. Up until, I would say, maybe the last 2 years or the last year, The common wisdom is just dump it all at once, all 8 episodes, all 10 episodes globally, just put out at the same time. And now everyone's doing like, oh, maybe we'll do 2 at once or like weekly. And it does extend the life of these shows. And even shows like Ozark's a great example. Season 4 is being split up into 2 different things. Stranger Things, season 4 is being split up into 2 different things. And Maisel is coming out twice a week for the next 4 weeks as of recording this, or the next 3 weeks for a total of 8 episodes in season 4, which I think will be unforgiving in some parts of the show, and I think will be a better watch in some parts of the show for Maisel, because we have nothing to like skip ahead to and, you know, go to the last chapter of the book and read the last page and the last sentence.
Yeah.
We just have what we have, and we're all having the same experience at the same time, which that part feels nice, of course.
So here's the thing. We opened season 4 with something, and I'm going, they're going to tell me what happened, right?
Oh, you're saying they're going to recap
the fact that we don't know what the fuck happened. Us, 2 people who made a podcast about this show. Like,
that's the thing that's wild, isn't it?
Don't remember what happened for sure.
Where I'm like, there was a plane, I think, and Shy Baldwin was there.
They can't not use it, right? Didn't use it. Mm-hmm. They're just like, you don't know. Like, I'm sorry. I don't know. I maybe they did use it a little bit, but it was just like, they should. A lot of shows do a lot of exposition at the beginning of a season, and this show is like, we'll skip it. I mean, it has so much dialogue. Why not just throw a little more exposition in there?
You're saying like exposition in the content of the episode, or you're saying like recap, like previously on Marvelous Mrs. Maisel?
Oh, I'm saying in the content of the episode. Like, Joel wants to know what happened. Somebody just explain to Joel what happened so that we remember.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Am I crazy? I still, to this day, what the fuck happened? I don't remember.
You don't remember? Do you want me to tell you what happened real quick?
That's the whole reason I showed up to the Zoom.
That's so nice of you to show up to the Zoom, by the way. So if you remember during season 3, Midge was opening for Shy Baldwin, a sort of, how would you say, almost like a Jackie Wilson-esque.
Yeah.
He was a closeted gay man. She did a show
at the Apollo
in which she kind of went off and sort of outed him as being queer. And really embarrassed him, at least, made a lot of jokes about him being lined the loafers, etc. And because of that, she got fired from the tour.
That's what I thought happened. And I'm going, how is she even the star of the show anymore? It's like crazy that she did that. Like, bitch, don't out someone.
You know, that with all of the closeted queer people I've worked with publicly, and privately, I've always chosen not to out them because that's what being professional
means. Continue to make that choice.
Yeah. You're making that choice with me. I'm making that choice with you right now. In 2022, you don't out anybody. You don't do it.
It's the most white woman-y thing to do, to out a queer black man and then be like mad that there was consequences for her. What?
Yes. Essentially pulling an Ian McKellen. I don't know if you remember this. Ian McKellen outed Lee Pace as being a gay man at one point in an interview.
But that's different because Lee Pace is not black. Is he? What if he was?
Well, he also outed him as a black man, too. Isn't that nuts? So, Alice, should we do it? Should we do the old song and dance that we used to do all those years ago?
I need it.
Yeah, I mean, you remember how this goes. You're definitely like me in that every time we do this, after a two-year break, you're not like, wait, what did I do on this show? What is this? What is this thing we've built for however many years of doing it?
This broke-down palace.
So, of course, it's time for a segment that we call...
12 o'clock, rock, we're going to
pop
around
culture
tonight.
The culture.
It's pop around the culture where we
the
take
culture.
Okay, thank you. We take every single reference in the two episodes that we watch, 401 and 402, and we put them together in a little pop culture supercut. So this is 401 and 402. Pop around the culture.
And a Christmas special with Bob Hope.
Pat Boone or Rosemary Clooney.
I'm talking Madea-level revenge.
Hey, Mata Hari.
I read Peter Rabbit.
Next up, Proust.
I don't know, but he's seen the sweet smell of success one too many times.
And I'm talking real revenge, not the, hey, I got you a lifetime subscription to the Watchtower kind of revenge.
We're talking full-on Francis Farmer.
Hey, any of you hear about this big new book by Harper Lee?
Beer.
Martini, olives.
Guess what her favorite drink is? Tequila Mockingbird.
She left it to Hal Roach of one Officer fucking Crumpkey.
For Tom Thumb, yes, or the Lollipop Guild, but not for normal-sized people.
Vincent Price, Edgar G. Robinson, Jan from Jan and Dean, Dean from Jan and Dean, Holland Wolf, Salvador Dali, Cubby O'Brien.
From the Mickey Mouse Club?
Fess Parker, Igor Stravinsky, Adlai Stevenson.
Like something out of that show of yours named The Twilight Zone. Well,
clearly a stand-in for Rod Serling.
Our photographer, Kal-El, from the planet Krypton.
I made the mistake of showing them my collection of Superman comics.
Hell, Naylor once showed up in his underwear.
I'm sorry, why'd he stab his wife again? She seemed nice.
Plimpton says it's because she told Norman he's not as good as Dostoevsky.
I had a long conversation with his wife at a book party once. She may have had it coming.
Okay. So that last one, I kind of want to dig in on for a second. So that's a roundtable discussion from the Village Voice staff, which Abe has joined, a writer, a theater critic for the newspaper. And they're talking about the incident in which Norman Mailer stabbed his wife. And the tag for that is a woman saying, I don't know, maybe she had it coming, which would be strange enough, Alice, if not for the fact that the Paladinos have literally worked with Norman Mailer. He was in a season 5 episode of Gilmore Girls in which him and his son go to the Dragonfly Inn and are just talking for a long time. And so it's very odd to me that they would reference this guy.
Mailer got them in the divorce for sure, right?
Sure. Yeah, I guess so.
We know whose side they're on.
You think they're on mail? It sounds like it, just given the quip of maybe she had it coming.
It's amazing.
It's very odd, right?
It's amazing and fucked up.
Yes, it's very, very fucked up. Any other pop culture references you found notable from this? We had one of those classic Daniel Paladino, just a list of names as Susie is visiting Sophie Lennon at the treatment center, talking about her past paramours.
Yeah. The Madea reference, they broke the fourth wall.
Yeah, hallelujah. You know, and that was cool of them to do. And so maybe they are.
They are trying to incorporate diversity in.
Yeah, by talking about Madea.
Tyler Perry reference here.
That's really cool.
It is.
And wouldn't you love it if Madea became a regular cast member?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, a new comic on the scene, you know?
So like we said at the top of the episode, we're going to talk about these two episodes, episode 401 and 402. 401, Rumble on the Wonder Wheel, the Amazon Prime synopsis is Midge returns with a new game plan after getting kicked off Shy Baldwin's tour. Joel is too successful for his own good. Susie finds a creative way to get the cash she needs. 402 is Billy Jones and the Orgy Lamps. The Amazon Prime synopsis is Midge has Abe and Rose over for dinner. Shirley tries to find Joel a new wife. An unexpected cab ride leads to new opportunities. So overall, Alice, what's your take? It's been 2 years. We probably haven't been rewatching it a lot in the intervening 2 years since we recorded those episodes for season three in January of 2020. How did coming back to this world feel like to you? And this sort of like soft reboot reset of the whole show's premise?
Yeah, I was like, do I like this show?
It's kind of the underlying question of all of our recaps of
yeah.
the show.
I really, this time though, was really like, I can't remember if I like this show or not.
Oh, I remember.
Midge is, I mean, credit to probably Rachel Brosnahan for being likable, but like beyond that, it's like a really not sympathetic hero for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not in like a Walter White keeps, you know, fucking up, but like anti-hero, but like
by the way, you saying Walter White keeps fucking up makes it sound like he's trying, but he keeps falling over and he's clumsy.
He's quirky.
Oh no, I made more meth. Oh shoot, and shucks.
Like I want to reshoot of Breaking Bad with Zooey Deschanel as the Walter White character. Like yikes. Yeah, I'm not sure because The we open with her just talking about revenge and the cigarette, right? And I'm like, oof, no.
Yes. Okay, so again, just to kind of recap it maybe for listeners or viewers who also haven't seen it in a while, she does, you know, essentially out a black man, a queer black man in 1959, 1960s, New York, and her response to it and internally, the thing is, oh, I was done wrong against for being kicked off this tour. I was going to go to Prague and going to go on this like international excursion. And I now have a thirst for blood and revenge. I've been wronged and I got to be me. And the whole kind of crux of it in the reset. And I guess the only way that this is really any different from even episode 102 or 103 of the first season is that she has put in some stage time and has experience performing at this point. And her grand revelation is that she has to be her.
Yeah.
And she has to do her thing specifically on stage. But it is quite wild that the response to a pretty fair and pretty even compassionate from Shy Baldwin's tour manager, as played by Sterling K. Brown, response is to let her go. And her response is instead, oh, another man has wronged me.
Yeah.
And men have done me wrong and now I need to be me.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, and maybe Joel did you wrong when when you got cheated on and all this stuff. But like, you know, and there's been times for sure. Like, but first of all, it was Joel. And then it was Sophie Lennon, who is not a man. Mm-hmm. And then now it's a guy that she fucked over really badly. Mm-hmm. And now what? Like, I don't, it's mind boggling. It baffles me. I don't understand. What I'm saying is I don't understand how they're trying to make this. Do they believe that we really root for her in 2022? You know what I mean? Like, well, people watching the show are like, oh, poor Mitch. Like, do they think that? Do they think we think that? I don't get it. It's
Here's
like Emily in Paris or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
I think it could be adjacent to that show. But we've had this conversation a lot about likable versus unlikable and the kind of inequity that's allowed for maybe women or female anti-heroes
for sure
in television space after like the kind of triage of Walter White, Tony Soprano, Don Draper.
Yes, we have.
And
yeah.
That sort of situation. And certainly there's room and space, even in television in the 2020s, for people who are deplorable, people that you would not want to hang out with and spend time with to be
right.
The quote-unquote protagonists or central characters that you follow in a show. I mean,
but the way that works is that the show knows what's up, right?
Do you still watch Succession? Are you familiar with it? Okay. So Succession is one of these shows where, like, obviously every single character in the show is like technically on paper a craven, sort of disgusting person who does disgusting things and is probably like a net negative for the world. But the way that Jesse Armstrong and the writers on that show contextualize those characters is that there is friction and bump, and especially there's like satirical framing around the whole situation. Not even that there's a POV character saying like, what are you guys doing? You're bad. You know, like calling it out in the content of the show. But there does seem to be this like really deftly crafted sort of distance from depiction equals endorsement.
Right.
Which is like the kind of distinction that fucks with everyone's heads in 2022, which is like, if someone is depicting something on screen, does that mean they're endorsing it? So if you show, a misogynist or homophobic or a racist character, does that mean you're endorsing said behavior? And the answer is obviously no. It just depends on like the framing of whatever the behavior and the depiction is. Mm-hmm. But in Maisel, the fact that her sort of like reaction to her own failure of professionalism in a stand-up context is vitriolic and like, well, I just got to double down. Like, I know I pissed someone off, but I just need to be me and to be myself. And I have a clip of that.
That gig, that Apollo gig, it went great. The crowd loved me.
I know.
And they loved me because I just went out there and started talking. I didn't have anything planned. I just riffed.
What's the point?
The point is that's always when I'm the best, Susie. Think about it. Think about my truly great shows. Not the good, solid, polished ones, but the ones that were epic.
You know, that first night drunken tit wagon show comes to mind.
The Sophie Lennon showcase?
That one still hurts.
But epic, right? The one you arranged with Lenny, the Penny Pan takedown, ruined my marriage and any chance at happiness, so great set.
Great fucking set. Detroit?
Kansas City? New Orleans?
Myrtle Beach?
And now, the Apollo. All those shows, one of a kind. The kind of shows that only I could do.
Agreed.
Susie.
Miriam.
You know what's great about me?
Your humility?
No. It's when I'm me. So why would I wait until I finally have enough power to say to them, I want to be me? What if they never let me be me?
They will.
I want to be me every time I walk out on that stage.
You will.
No, listen. If I'm going to do this, Susie, if I'm going to leave Esther and Ethan for weeks on end, miss their birthdays, real and fake, their recitals and school plays, I'm not going to do it for a bunch of lipstick jokes or bad room service jokes.
Yeah, but
no, if I'm going to do that, I'm going to say exactly what's on my mind. All the time, every single show, I am going to say something.
So there's so much that I want to unpack from that particular exchange in terms of what it's saying about integrity, what Midge is trying to say about her own career and whatnot. Obviously, like, we can repeat some of the greatest hits of, like, that's not how stand-up works. It's not just like riffing and doing the first 10 minutes of WTF with Marc Maron. That's not what stand-up is. It's like refining and honing, you know, word choice and literal like syntax or emphasis. It's like refining material over time and then being adaptable in certain situations. It's not just like, oh no, I'll do an ASCAP monologue every time I get up there. We've talked about that so much. But I'm so fascinated by kind of what I'm understanding to be the arc of ASP's career, and then a lot of the criticism that maybe her like upside down or the doppelganger, her tethered, I should say, Aaron Sorkin also gets as well.
Yeah.
Aaron Sorkin being the more kind of glorified prestige-y version of ASP. Both fast crackling, snappy, bantery dialogue, both had TV shows that were hits and had tremendous cultural footprint in the 2000s. And then, you know, Sorkin is like soared to heights of Oscar-winning stardom and is one of the most famous screenwriters alive. And Palladino, finally, with Maisel, is sort of a TV titan. She's got an overall deal with Amazon. She'll be making TV until she dies. But they're both very old, first of all. They're both, you know, people in their 50s, pushing 60.
You can call that very old.
I'm saying just in the context of, like, what I'm sort of nervous this show is getting at in this monologue. But one, I think both of those creators, especially as time goes on and there's more work to examine of their output and their entire catalog, I think it's becoming clear after watching Being the Ricardos too, you know, a fictionalization of events behind the scenes of I Love Lucy with Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz, that every character, including a 1950s comedy star, becomes a mouthpiece for Sorkin. There's not like a lot of critical distance of I wouldn't talk like this. It's kind of like Lucille Ball is me in this moment, and I'm speaking truth to power.
It's Woody Allen.
Yes, which we'll get to Woody Allen later. In this,
we will.
Oh, we sure will.
We will, baby.
And that's also the thing with ASP as well, which like people have said, oh, the protagonist of each of her three major shows is a tall brunette woman who talks fast, and there's things like that. But especially in particular with this monologue, where she's saying, I have to be me all the time. It's not worth it unless I get to do exactly what I want to do. You could imagine her saying that to a boardroom of Amazon executives arguing for a larger hat budget for season four of the show. You can imagine her saying it to ABC Family or whoever was airing Bunheads at the time. It was ABC Family, where it's like, no, we need more money for dance rehearsals for the girls. Mm-hmm. You can imagine her saying it to the WB and Netflix executives for Gilmore Girls, where it's like, no, we're going to need two more shooting days because it's not worth it for me to make this show for you unless I do it exactly how I want. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely framed as integrity, but the context, the fictional context and the narrative of the show does make it sound so bananas where it's like, oh yeah, I got to kind of like, you know, commit a social crime against this person who's been nothing but lovely to me and really trusted me with his life and sexuality. Yeah, I got to be me. I don't know. Like that is her takeaway is very perplexing. The other thing I'm worried about, Alice, and I wondered if you picked up on this too, is that it feels like what she's edging up against is like, I have to say exactly what I want to say all the time. And it feels like perhaps, which is why I say Amy and Daniel, they're not youngins. They don't give a flying fuck about what's trending on Twitter.
Yeah.
In the sense that they don't care what your pronouns are.
Yeah.
And they don't care what's in the bio or not. I wonder if they're making this sort of like 1960 contextualized argument against cancel culture and against censorship.
Yeah.
Of like, we should be able to say whatever we want to say. We should be able to do whatever we want to do. Did you feel that listening to her?
I'm sure. Anyone who's had the ability to, I would say anyone who's been through what people who've worked really long and hard in this industry, even via nepotism, like it's this industry is so crushing, and so like getting shows on the air is so soul crushing and difficult. And like my showrunner on this show says, like being a showrunner is like being beaten to death with your own dream. It's like the worst and hardest thing to do. And anybody who's been through that, who then sees this outside force of some sort of like cancellation army coming for them, like it's the traps are so easy to fall into, to say, fuck that. I worked too hard, too long for this to then become accountable to a bunch of Twitter SJWs. Like, I'm sure people feel that way. And I'm sure to a certain extent, Amy and Dan feel that way. Two things. Do you think Miss Julie, the production of Miss Julie, is an allegory for Aaron Sorkin taking on To Kill a Mockingbird?
Miss Julie being the Sophie Lennon kind of bomb that she did last season. That is so funny, especially given the To Kill a Mockingbird name check later in the episode.
Right? Because like that's the thing I'd say. If I were Amy, I'd go, yeah, I get a lot of comparisons to Aaron Sorkin. Yeah, Aaron Sorkin's like my doppelganger in this industry. But like, guess which one of the two of us had the hubris to take on To Kill a Mockingbird and fail? Wasn't me. You know what I mean? Like, so whatever. But
that's so funny. I'm doing the research right now, Alice. And the show did premiere on Broadway December 13th, 2018. So it definitely premiered before they would have turned in the script.
I'm saying it's possible. Sort of, I don't think it really is, but
no, I'm connecting the dots. I'm dropping what you're saying.
Okay. And then also the other thing about this monologue that I'd like to point out with in context with how the show is, the arc of the character is created, like problematic for me with the stand-up on this show has always been like a huge pivot point, a huge anchor for Midge's motivation in everything that she does is that she's really good at this one thing. And in a lot of shows, it's really easy to show like somebody who's really good at one thing. Thor, really good at throwing the hammer. You just do the special effects, the hammer comes back, and he's like, nobody else can do the hammer. And everybody's like, totally, agree with that. You wouldn't watch a Marvel movie with Thor and go, I don't think he's so good at the hammer. He is, you know it, right?
And but in the new Thor, he does try stand-up for the first time, he's really funny.
What I'm saying is there's so few times when we see Midge actually bomb that we don't know when she's good or bad. Like, They don't show her having these epic shows, right? Like, it doesn't...
No, they do. No, they do show her having shows. You're just saying that the contrast is
right
lost.
Now, unless you agree with me.
I agree with you, basically. I'm just being pedantic about a detail. That
was so funny when you were being dumb. I really do feel this way. I don't feel like there's a time when she's talking on stage where you're meant to go, that's her being her and it's so good, because it just isn't.
Oh, I disagree. I think the show is doing that.
I don't think so. The times in the show when she's really
cooking
and standing out to me are when she's like talking one-on-one with somebody in her life. When she's doing the stand-up, I just don't know if it might be Rachel Brosnahan, it might be the writing, it might be something else, the directing, but to me, it's always pushing. I never get anything from it. I'm always like, it just comes across as really flat to me. And that's a big problem for me to be invested in the show.
Yes. Well, yeah. But I think in the context of the show, you are meant to, as a viewer, be watching it and think, oh my goodness, she's absolutely killing it. They're rolling in the aisles. They were rolling in the aisles at the Apollo. They're rolling in the aisles when she did the Penny Pan takedown, all that stuff. I'm saying that's
the
what
Penny
you're
Penny Pan takedown was good, but that's personal. I don't like the scene when she's like doing the thing in episode 2 when she's like doing the guy's stand up and there's like a mixed reaction.
Mm-hmm.
I just like those things are so fascinating to me, and it feels like they're just sort of like puppet show. You know what I mean? Like they're not blowing that out the way that they could be. Like, I just want a world, a mythology established. Like, what's good in this world? What's not good in this world? If people are laughing at these cheesy jokes from this guy, then that's good in that world. Because we're not going to get, you know, a Dave Chappelle special out of Midge, obviously. Right?
I hope not. God.
Well, no, but like, or whoever the like, you know, Bill Burr or whoever the like, the John Mulaney, the thing that like, you know, we could watch at home and see clips of it as a stand-up special in the show in context and go like, that's actually funny, you know? All right. So my last point about the show and how it
in conclusion and so forth
is we agree to disagree. So that's kind of crazy, right?
No, I think we're just like slightly, we've had this conversation, Alice, like 4 million times of the stand-up in the show.
No, we haven't.
Yes, we have. We absolutely have.
I don't remember. It's been 4 years.
It's been 2 years. You don't even remember how many years it's been.
Shit. Okay. Well, yeah, we have had this conversation. I guess then only to say still a problem and maybe even a bigger problem for me now because they're it's really snowballing now. Snowballing.
It kind of gets to the central tension of the show, which is that I've been thinking about this a lot while watching the aforementioned Euphoria, which we were talking about off mic before we started recording. Mm. And with that show, watching season 2, which other than a few parts, I'm not really enjoying so much. And the problem for me with season 2 of Euphoria has been, I don't know what we're supposed to care about the most, because it doesn't feel like season 2 of Euphoria has a North Star of what is like the utmost of stakes for all these high school kids. Is the big underlying question, are Rue and Jules going to stay together? Is Rue going to get clean? Are Cassie and Nate going to make it? Or is Alexa Demi's character going to go to college? There's no kind of thing to hang everything on where it's kind of driving it. In the way, not to keep bringing it up as an example, but Succession, the fundamental question is, who's going to take over the company?
Who's going to take over the company?
And everything kind of hangs on that. Or even other shows, like even something less plot-driven like Parks and Rec, which is, okay, how do we execute good government and help Leslie and be supportive of her in local politics, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And with Maisel, the purported central question of the show is Midge going to make it?
Yeah.
Are we going to see the completion of the arc where she becomes the biggest stand-up superstar that she's supposed to be. Is she going to become the Joan Rivers, essentially? But along the way, there's so much about the show that's actually just an ensemble show that has nothing to do with that question. Whereas other shows are a little bit tighter, everything, even when it feels digressive, feels like it comes back to that as an issue.
Yeah.
But because there's so much just riffraff and, okay, Abe's at the Village Voice now and
right.
Joel's in bed with the Chinese mafia, you know, like that it becomes so, oh, this is actually probably just a show about the 60s.
Yeah.
But they're doing this thing at the same time that's like, oh, you're supposed to be investing in that as a central journey. I just don't know how successful it is at that because there is so much digression.
Yeah.
With like the fact that Joel is still a character, that Joel's parents are main cast characters on the show, feels like that betrays what would be the central. It feels like someone like Bailey DeYoung as Imogen should be someone who's main cast, not Caroline and Kevin Pollak as her in-laws, but so Imogen, like, oh, we need to see Midge in a different context in this relationship, not just like go on a safari at the Wonder Wheel on, you know, Coney Island.
Interesting.
In 1960. It feels like, I don't want to say it's like dishonest because that's not the right word, but it does just feel like either broaden it out so it's Midge is one of five even stories of, a couple of Jewish families in the Upper East Side of Manhattan in 1960.
Right.
Or tighten the shit out of it. So it is just like, all right, these parents are gone. Tony Shalhoub is recurring now. Esther and Ethan, we don't even see, even less so than they're already not on the show. And really focus in on the stand-up stuff. Luke Kirby as Lenny Bruce is in every single episode now.
For sure.
But they're not quite doing that. I would be really curious.
Whatever gets Lenny Bruce into every single episode for me. But I liked the show better when it was about Midge discovering that her life trajectory was not working for her and that it was about this person in this context choosing a different type of life for themselves. And mm-hmm. I got a hint of that when she rearranged her bedroom, you know, when she was saying like, I gotta be me, you know, and then she just rearranges her bedroom in a weird way. That was an interesting allegory for me for like, I'm gonna be an artist in this space only. And will that work? And then it like doesn't work at all. And I like the show when it's about that. But for it to be a show about like this ensemble, I could make the argument that Joel's in-laws are there to represent the fact that like she's still tethered to this world mm-hmm. and she can't ever cut those bonds because for her, a Jewish girl from the upper whatever side in the 60s, it's not possible. But the Joel, I could make the argument for Joel that like, gee, he's there to be that old life, like, you know, and he's doing his new thing. So like, they're all tethered to this old life, but it isn't doing that, is it? That's like a really flimsy excuse at this point because it has gone off the rails. And then for me, it's like, I can't really care about her choices anymore. If like, and her like, oh, it's like, my life isn't what it used to be. And I have these kids and I have this marriage, but like, I need something more. I can't care about that because the something more she's choosing is like, I need to out a black queer man at the Apollo. Like, I don't understand. Like, it's just like, okay.
The nobility of the profession in terms of breaking sort of patriarchal gender roles in the 1950s, yes, it does have a little less weight to it.
Yeah.
In season four, especially as it becomes, this might be another.
Also, she's like inventing feminism now. Like, people are just like going to her shows because she just talks like, it's just weird. It bothers me that people are like sitting in an odd, it drives me crazy, actually, that she'll go on stage and go, men are this and women don't get anything. And then the audience will go, yeah. I'm like, what? In what world is this 1960s New York? Like, I don't know. Like, I don't know if that's even really, you know what I mean? Like, it's just like, what is the world?
I don't know. I wasn't in Greenwich Village in 1960. Maybe that was the case.
I wasn't either. But like, we know that like the Summer of Love was 1969. And there's this whole like second wave of feminism happening around the 60s. But like, what does that cultural touch point, like, how does that play into what Midge, Like, what's in the water right now? And why is it like that the only things that are in the water are the things that Midge is putting there? I don't get it. It's it's weird. And also, I guess Susie can just go to the forest magically.
Well, okay, now that might be something we need to talk about. So
I think that's a separate thing.
Man. So one of the, I'll remind you and listeners again since season three. So Susie was in charge of Midge's money, all her touring money that she made with Shy Baldwin. But then Susie was concurrently developing, maybe I think starting in Vegas for those episodes, a gambling problem. And she does at one point put all of Midge's money on a horse race, and then she loses it all. And which is bad because Midge buys back
in the crossover Riverdale episode.
In a crossover Riverdale episode, yeah, she goes to Riverdale, sees KJ Apa, the whole gang. But at one point, she's trying to, you know, she's hitting different people up for the money. They go to the insurance company, her and her sister do, and that doesn't quite shake out yet. And then at one point, she's drowning her sorrows in a bar. And this is something I'd be so curious, and this is one of the joys and frustrations, but I think ultimately positive things about watching this sort of thing week to week. She goes to a bar and she sees a sort of close-up magician who might actually be
magical,
a wizard for real, an actual magical person, not just like a con artist in Brooklyn, but
like this guy from the Umbrella Academy.
Actually, because at one point he's doing a coin trick to her and like, oh, where's the coin in this hand or that hand? He does snap his fingers and Susie does get transported into the middle of a calendar painting and then gets snapped out of it momentarily in a flight of fancy that is cinematically unlike anything the Paladinos have ever done, save for the Across the Universe homage that they did in A Year in the Life, in which all of the Life and Death Brigade did that song for like what felt like an hour of the episode. It was unbelievable. And you do wonder, especially as you look at the body of work over these decades, is this supposed to be a callback to Jess Mariano doing close-up magic in Stars Hollow in season two? And I don't think it is, even though we will see Milo Ventimiglia later in this season. As we will see Kelly Bishop later in this season.
This is us.
This really is us. Do you think they're going to do a sequel show called This Was Us?
Yes, I do. So... yeah, like that's the kind of thing that happens where it's like, are the Paladinos okay? You know, like we're where Susie is just like transported into a calendar, and the explanation is that you bought that guy a drink, and you're like, oh, you know, if I'm a Netflix executive, I'm watching that going like,
Netflix the competitor. You're watching that saying, uh-oh.
No, Netflix itself. Like, we gave her all this money, and she's like, I need the money. Itself. I'm sorry. Oh, Amazon. Sorry, Amazon. Yeah, sorry. I keep thinking it's on Netflix. Sorry.
Again.
Sorry, and I can't apologize enough. I'm so sorry.
Jeff Bezos bald, Amy Sherman Palladino. Reed Hastings hair, Dave Chappelle. Yeah. That's how we remember that. And the people that get wild amounts of money.
Oh, thank you for going over that with me again.
Oh, gracious. So... the money subplot, by the way, gets wrapped up within the episode where she's on the line for some money because she bought her apartment back and Susie's holding her money. She gets the money back via Joel. Joel gives her the money, but Joel doesn't want Mitch to know that the money came from him because his business and nightclub is doing very well. And it's sort of wrapped up. The sort of frustration I have, and this also gets into maybe a larger, broader conversation or question of, is The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel a drama or a sitcom? Is because of the sort of circular nature or the cyclical nature lot of the story. By the end of episode one of season four, materially, the characters are not that much in a different spot.
Yeah.
And to be clear, like Midge isn't in that much of a different spot than she was in the previous seasons, other than saying like, I gotta be me, I'm really good at this and I know it, I've done all these shows and I gotta be me. But even in 402, she does offer to have her parents move back into the apartment that she bought using Joel's money, which she doesn't know about. But like, I guess the setup, and it seems to be clear by the end of episode two, is that she's living with her parents again, exactly as it was in season one. So the status quo has kind of been reset. So the conversation largely that I want to get into is kind of whether Maisel is primarily a sitcom or a drama, because sitcom, the whole mm-hmm. thing is, I don't care about the story. I don't care about the propulsion of the narrative. Who gives a shit? I just want to hang out with these characters and spend mm-hmm. some time with it.
Yeah.
Dramas kind of more function on the mechanism of plot. And this right. episode leads into this episode, and you're going to see what happens next on Ozark and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. You got to check it out. And this is just, yeah, they're kind of hanging out again. She's going to do stand-up, yeah. and maybe she's,
exactly.
she got an idea from the burlesque show. But, yeah, you know, we'll see. And yeah. that said, too, Alice, it has been renewed Kevin. For a fifth and final season, Mrs. Maisel has. There's one more season of the show after season four.
Oh, my God.
So after these two episodes, there's six more episodes this season. Let's say season five is eight more episodes. There's 10 episodes left in this whole show. How does Midge Maisel, from the end of 402 to the end of 508, get to a series finale satisfactory catharsis in that short of a time? It feels odd, especially because season three felt so iterative and progressive from the foundation laid by season one and two, where it's like, okay, she's touring, she's in the mix, she's in showbiz again. And unless it's like leaps and bounds in the next couple episodes, it's hard to imagine what it's going to look like. I don't know.
Yeah. Does she go back to just brisket?
Yeah, that's the series finale. It's like, you know what? I actually like being a wife and mother. I'm going home, baby.
That's the thing.
She ties her apron on in slow motion while a Barbra Streisand song plays.
Fuck yes. Yeah. Fuck yes. I realized, you know, I outed that guy and it was probably my bad.
You know what? I'm not cut out for show business. You have a good Midge Maisel. I haven't heard it in 2 years.
I don't want to. Don't pimp me into it.
I'm not pimping you into it. I'm just giving you an unprompted compliment that you have a good Midge Maisel.
I got to ease into it. There's like a friction between the two kinds of show that it is. And I think Gilmore Girls like really did this well, mm-hmm. right? The course of the two different protagonist stories throughout Gilmore was really well done, I think. And this, it's sort of like the first season went off with like a shot. Like this is what you care about. This is the story. And then, yeah, it's languishing and it's becoming like, now we can build out all these other stories. It's a serious, like it's scary. It's existential for me because my show might get a season three. And I'm wondering, you know, it's a show about an alien. But it's always been an ensemble at the same time. So it's like, well, you know, how do our characters fit in? So I'm always looking for how my character and everybody's characters fit into this like worldwide catastrophic event that is or is not possibly going to happen and like where we all fit in. And because I don't think the show works that well without that.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, like the thing to hang your hat on. And there's nothing to hang your hat on anymore. Because we don't know what Midge wants. We don't know if she should even get what she wants if she does want it. Like, yeah, okay, she wants to be her, okay? Like I've said before, I don't see what that is. Don't know what that means. So no material? Okay. I don't think, having watched this show for whatever many years, I've ever seen her do material, but okay.
You know what? She did do material, I think, a little bit in season one. Remember, she had the... This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Squarespace. Now, unlike anything I've ever talked about on the air, I actually stand by Squarespace. I actually do because I've used it for everything I've made. Literally, GilmoreGuysShow.com, the very website for this very podcast, was made using Squarespace. How beautiful is that? KevinTPorter.com, I made that using Squarespace. My old bake shop website, that was made using Squarespace. Because you can do it all with Squarespace. You can sell content on your website. So exclusive stuff behind a paywall. You can sell memberships, courses, or sell files your customers can download, like PDFs, music, or eBooks. You can do that with Squarespace. You can do analytics with Squarespace. So you can figure out who's visiting your website and why. And figure out how to get traffic and where's it coming from. You can also have people do flexible payments on Squarespace. Make checkout seamless for your customers with simple but powerful payment tools. Accepts credit cards, PayPal, Apple Pay, and in eligible countries, offer customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and ClearPay. How nice is that? You can also do email campaigns, so there's constant outreach for your stuff and people know where to find you. So I'm going to let you know where to find Squarespace Head to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/GilmoreGuys to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. That's squarespace.com/GilmoreGuys.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Cards that she was going off
of. Yeah, right. That was the one.
There was like
time,
a montage, though. I think. It might have been season one or season two. I don't know. It'd be so curious.
And I liked that. I liked that moment when it was happening. Like, let's learn how to craft material. And it's just ever since then, just the key. To me, it's just like if you were watching Thor and he just like was like, now I'm throwing the hammer. And he always threw it off camera.
The go-to example.
That's how it feels.
Thor.
It is. It's a perfect analogy. And I don't have any problem with it.
The job being hammer throwing.
Dude, I don't know. Like, maybe if he just, like, you know, or it's Thanos snapping his fingers and he always snaps over here and then you don't see what happens.
So
I don't know.
Thanos goes into the gaslight. He's snapping his fingers and Susie sees him from the bar. He's like, she's got something. That's the snapping of the fingers. I can make something out of that. We're going to go to Carnegie Hall.
Oh, so you would snap your fingers and eliminate half of humanity. Can we choose which humanity?
Can we choose which half?
So that's sort of fundamental, the stuff we're talking about.
Sure.
Do you want to get into specifics?
Specifics as
far as... Do you have any segments?
Oh, specific segments? Well, literally the only specific segment I had for this was the Twitter Q&A, which we can get to later.
Okay, so I want to talk about the Wonder Wheel trip, because I think that was maybe the most Palladino-y.
This is the Woody Allen of it all, Alice, because...
Oh, here we go. I knew we'd get to it.
Of course, in 2017... Woody Allen, just 5 years ago, the same year that The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel pilot debuted on Amazon Prime before the whole show was picked up, made a little film you might have heard of called Wonder Wheel. And Wonder Wheel...
Woody Allen made Wonder Wheel.
Wonder Wheel is a little film starring Kate Winslet, Jim Belushi, Juno Temple, and Justin Timberlake. An absolutely thrilling ensemble of people that definitely make sense together as a cast. And of course, took place, in the same place. The Coney Island Amusement Park, the titular Wonder Wheel, set in the early 1950s. This is in 1960. And this is, of course, Amy Sherman Palladino's grand tribute to one of her literal heroes. That is not a joke. That Woody Allen is definitely one of her big main influences and heroes. She's aped his sequences before, like Husbands and Wives and Friday Night's All Right for Fighting in season 6 of Gilmore, and has cited Hannah and Her Sisters as maybe her favorite movie of all time. One of his movies.
I think it's okay maybe with like you can steal from Woody Allen, and that's okay.
Yeah, I think so.
You know what I mean? Like, I think that's okay to ape. If you're going to take from a Roman Polanski, it doesn't mean you're like, I'm super cool with child rape, you know?
No, of course not. So yes, the sequence that we're referring to is one in which the whole family gets together on a Ferris wheel in Coney Island to celebrate Ethan's fake birthday. I did think that was a very funny device that the parents just made up a new birthday for Ethan that fit in better with their schedules. Yeah. I thought was an incredibly funny touch. And
the part when she's on the phone with... What's the dad's name? Sorry.
Abe?
Fuck you. What? I don't know.
It's Abe.
Say it like that.
I'm sorry. Was it Abe? I don't know.
Thank you for that adjustment. Mm-hmm. When she's on the phone with Abe and she's complaining about making a new birthday, and Abe's like, you know, we changed your brother's birthday twice. And she's like, wait, did you change my birthday? And he's like, no. Like, I love the way he says no, because, you know, the way he says it is like perfectly, like, oh, wait, maybe they did. You know, she doesn't know when her real birthday is great.
I love it.
Juicy little detail.
You know, one of those things in this show, the ensemble finally comes back together for a big scene. One of the classic, everyone on the call sheets in the same scene at the same time, but it's on a Ferris wheel. So they are in different cars yelling at each other the whole time. And just a quick survey, not only from our Twitter Q&A, but just like searching Twitter right now, the first thing everyone brings up is, wow, the scene on the Ferris wheel really bugged me. Well, there was one person in our Q&A that said, like, I really liked it. I hope y'all like it. Because the mechanism of it is that they're having a big truth-telling discussion and kind of a come-to-Jesus moment with each other. Like, actually, this is the status quo. Actually this. And all these revelations are happening. But the mechanism by which all that stuff is delivered is that they are screaming it at each other. And it's definitely, like, one of the more, like, broader sort of AST touches in the whole thing. And I do believe that we do have a little clip of it. Let me pull that up.
I can help her out.
With what?
Sonia was not a matchmaker.
Of course she was.
No. Matchmakers get paid. No one paid her.
Your mother paid her.
What?
Abe, for God's sake, you were 30 and unmarried. Plus your wardrobe. They had to throw in a savings bond and a Turkish ceremonial rifle set for my father.
That's where he got that?
I need a pen. Who has a pen?
Okay, so this scene does take place over the course of 39 minutes of the episode. It is just all of them yelling at each other, and it is a sort of... It's the equivalent of what an action set piece is in a John Wick or Fast and Furious movie, where it's like, okay, now this is a really bad car chase, or this is something Halle Berry and Keanu had to train 5 months to do. But the ASP equivalent of a set piece is a lot of yelling, a lot of quick, fast yelling, and all these interesting setups in a interesting location.
What is the thing that people on Twitter are complaining about? They just didn't like it.
I think
were they like wine mom cringe?
Wine mom.
Oh, it's so cringe, wine mom.
I think just generally the sort of effect that a lot of yelling and a lot of yelling often about nothing, like the matchmaker, who paid off who, blah blah blah, that sort of thing. Because I think the cumulative effect is supposed to be, it's very absurd that they're having this sort of personal conversation in a very public space. But the overall effect is like, you know, like it's funny when they yell and bicker. Just kind of the go-to thing on the show. So,
and people don't like what?
They don't like the annoying effect that it might have, I think.
I think that the way that this scene works in the context of the show larger, for me, is... pivotal, because
pivotal
it is.
Go off.
I will, queen. So the fucking
thank you, queen,
idea behind these like romps, I think of town hall scenes with people having arguments at town hall,
sure,
and everybody
all
the extras. There's just like really specific ASP relationship with extras, like background actors in her shows. The purpose that they serve is to be the audience to these main characters. You know, unlike in normal narratives, like background actors are there to provide atmosphere, they're to provide like sometimes obstacle or generally a chorus of like, this is how the world in that our characters are inhabiting is reacting to something. In this show, specifically, so often background is an audience to our characters' antics. Like, you can see that in the line on the way up to the Wonder Wheel. The way people are reacting to the family is like they're having reactions as like, it's hard to describe, but like they're props, you know what I mean? Like they're thrown around like, oh, this is happening over here, and like, you know, but they're like, it's a show. I don't know. It's strange to me that in this Wonder Wheel sequence, people are yelling and all our main characters are yelling at each other. And like, obviously if this was a grounded experience, the other people who were on the Wonder Wheel, the whole time we'd be able to hear them. It wouldn't just be at the end, one guy saying, shut up.
Yeah.
It would be the whole time. This whole thing would be impossible because in a grounded show, people like are people. They're not like an audience for our main characters who come in at the perfect time with a button. Right. And so that, to me, it rubs with the way that this show is about a performer. You know what I mean? Like, if the audience is regular, just a normal grounded audience when they go to midget shows. But then in the rest of the world, there are women in jail who are like, yeah, pick a little, talk a little, cheap, cheap, cheap. You know, like they're the music man, the people from the town that could break into song at any time. Like, I don't get it. It's just, it really, it's like a, it's disharmony, right? It's disharmonious storytelling to me. That this show is about a stand-up comedian that exists in a world where everybody is literally a stand-up comedian. All the characters we care about perform a show all the time for people in the streets that are like sweeping by going like, okay, let's see you later, Mr. Marble. You know, it just, yeah, it's strange to me. Like the audience needs to kind of be separated from the rest of the world audience in a way that isn't being done elegantly and bothers me. Because I like the Wonder Wheel sequence. I like that stuff about Amy Sherman Palladino. That's why I tune in. So I'm anxious for them to figure it out, and they're not going to.
When do you think the show is functioning at its best in season four? Like as a pure pleasurable watch, when are you having the most fun watching the show? Because I think I can answer it for me, and it's almost like kind of my take with some television I've watched recently, where as an aesthetic pleasure in terms of literal just sights and sound, like almost like pretty lights and pretty
definitely
music, I still find the needle drops in the show to be fairly immaculate, and the musical taste of it being
music is unbelievably good.
It's that stuff and mixing in Broadway picks with just sort of, standard pop stuff from 50s and 60s music. And then some of the anachronistic stuff they go out on the credits, I really love. And I really appreciate it. I think after not watching it for 2 years, watching 401 felt really nice to get back into the bubble bath or the blanket of like ASP talk and the bantry stuff. And after watching this stuff for going on 22 years of my life, I'm like, you know what? This still feels good to me to kind of be in that world.
Yeah, so that there's two moments I can point out. The moment where Abe, prior to the Wonder Wheel, is like, I thought this was like exquisite. Abe is walking and trying to get people to the Wonder Wheel. So for some reason, Abe is stressed out that they're even at Coney Island, and he just wants them to go to the Wonder Wheel and leave. And everybody else is like normal being at Coney Island, and he just needs them to go so that they can leave. And he's walking with this group of people, and the two kids keep grabbing his hands. And I can see, like, I even like can rewind and watch the points at which the actual kid actors are not doing a good job of like trying to grab his hands, and he has to like keep it going. But it's just so, it's such a funny character detail that like it's like, you know how like people who are allergic to cats always like them. Abe hates kids. You know, he's yet another stand-in for ASP who hates kids. And he doesn't want to be there. He doesn't want to play with kids. He's not entertained by kids. He finds kids to be, you know, an annoyance. And these kids, for that reason alone, he's the one not buying them. You know, Joel's mom would be the one that would want the kids around. But like Abe hates the kids, and the kids keep grabbing his hands. Like they want to hold hands with him all the time. And he's just like, stop it, stop it. He has to stop his monologue and go like, please stop. And what we know he's saying is like, he doesn't ever say stop grabbing my hand, but he's making them, he's like, get off me. And I loved it. I thought it was really great. Mm-hmm. And then the other piece was the mysterious hallway off the central office in the insurance adjusters company. The doorway opens off the hallway, and it's just like this really weird, like sort of deep throat X-Files like debriefing room where Susie and Tess have to go be interviewed by this insurance adjuster.
Mm-hmm.
It amounted to nothing, right? Of course it amounted to nothing. So it's just for pure pleasure of like watching this situation where, you know, our character just needs this money turn into them being taken by like the insurance gulag.
Yeah. And you do kind of wonder, because I love the production design of that too. And what they said going into season four, because they had to do it all in New York, is they said, well, we just had to build a lot of sets, and we had to, you know, break the bank on building stuff, which was even harder because of literal supply chain issues and getting lumber and plastics and construction going. Costs a lot, but that's what made sense for COVID. And thus far, I really, in these two episodes, haven't felt the COVID of it all. But what I have felt is a sort of kind of consistent with the last three seasons, a real attention to detail and the sumptuousness of 1960 production design, which remains very lovely. Now, the one thing I wish, and something I've been thinking about a lot, just in the sense of how they shoot things, which I like that they do things in wides and long one-ers and in one take things. I do wish that the show looked a little bit more like the time period in the sense of the graininess of film versus the kind of pristine, like blemishlessness of digital video, which it's obviously shot on. And digital is always
interesting,
less expensive than film. Mm-hmm. Film is more expensive. Sometimes digital is a lot more convenient. It's usually a lot more convenient to shoot on instead of like 11 or 12 minute takes that you get on a film magazine. You can do it for 30, 40, 50 minutes on digital, which is not the case. And certain shows can afford to shoot on film, but they probably could have the option and didn't care enough to because it wasn't worth it to them. But something about, I don't know, even watching Euphoria, which like for as many like weird, as much weird stuff as I have with it, it is gorgeously shot on grainy ass looking film, which looks so beautiful in that context and gives it so much sort of tactility and gravity to it. I do wonder what all that same production design would look like through the literal lens of a 35 millimeter camera rather than a digital video camera, kind of aping the 35 millimeter look. Because it looks a little digital, you know, it looks a little spotless in a way where it's like, yes, this show was definitely shot in the 2020s in that sense. But yes, I'm looking forward to that. And you do wonder what the show would be like if they leaned into even more the sort of fantastical nature of some of that stuff. Like you're talking about the long hallway and it's like, ooh, this is something that I would see in like Barton Fink or Coen Brothers movie. Where it's just like, oh, okay, we're just doing this now. And even like we were joking about Susie disappearing into the calendar. I'm like, I would see a sort of like dreamy version of ASP's idea of the 1960s. That's appealing to me. Maybe that's what season four would be because they get bored.
Yeah, exactly. Like if we're not going to hang our hat on Midge's main arc anymore, right? Like what are we doing? And let's just do what we do best.
Have fun.
Right. And I think the Wonder Wheel sequence did that. It had everybody, all the characters that they clearly want to be a part of the show who have no other reason to be there except that Amy wants them there, you know, doing what they do best. So I thought that was great.
And continuing with the sort of repertory cast of ex-Gilmore and Bunhead players that show up in Maisel, there will be Bishop and Ventimiglia later in the show. But in 402 at the Village Voice, did you notice a certain someone was running the meeting? Chris Eigenman, who played Digger in seasons four.
I did recognize him.
That gentleman was playing, I guess, the editor-in-chief of the Village Voice, looking very, you know, gray in the hair and very handsome and aged pretty well. And a performer I'm always happy to see. And we're finally getting into Abe's really, I'm sure, important story about being a theater critic at the Village Voice at this point in history. We're also tying up loose ends with Susie stuff in 402. She used to manage Sophie Lennon, as played by Jane Lynch, who has checked herself into an institution of some sort because she wanted to after her disastrous To Kill a Mockingbird stint on Broadway. And we check in with David Paymer's character. I believe his name is Harry Drake. And they have a nice little walk and talk in Central Park. And that was one of my favorite scenes across the two episodes is just anything where it's Susie talking shop with someone else who's like, managing is this or that, or you could drop her.
And loved that.
She's like, no, I love her, you know.
Also, it was like deeply accurate. You know, that was the other thing is like, he's been truths, you know. This guy is like not, you know, he's not presenting like some fanciful version of Hollywood. This is literally like, I just know these conversations happen, like where you're like, Susie and Midge are like this really weird anomaly, right? Like a manager who, I mean, maybe now in modern times, but probably also in the 60s, a manager who is like singularly devoted to a client and they have this really kind of close relationship that is pretty codependent, but also, you know, the heart of the show. The heart of this narrative, at least, like, and him going, dumper, like, and that, like, being kind of a gut punch, because we know that it's, that's really kind of a thing that Susie might want to think about at some point, mm-hmm. right? And I thought it was great. I thought it was a wonderful scene to include.
Yeah, I loved it a lot. That said, between the two episodes, you definitely feel, okay, who's clickety-clacking behind the typewriter this time for this script? Oh, right. We got poopy jokes. Okay, we got vomit jokes. Okay, we got just a list of names. Sounds like Daniel got the Final Draft Pro open, and damn, do you feel it. This is not a show with, you know, they're basically, I think maybe one episode in season one was credited to someone else. I'm struggling to remember now, but it's just them. This is it. And they have their little writer's room, and Noah Garden Schwartz is in it, and Jen Kirkman continues to consult on the stand-up elements of it, if you go by the credits. So it's just them, and man, I'll just never get over the noticeable gap between an Amy script and a Daniel script. Because for as like kind of frustrating or like, what are we doing here in episode one that I kind of felt from time to time, I'm still drifted off in just the sort of pleasure of, if you put this on mute at a bar, I would still be enjoying it. And I'm enjoying all the music and whatnot. And then episode two, there's just jokes and even colloquialisms that feel anachronistic. Like Susie saying, well, this sucks or something, where it's like, is this 1960?
Yeah, totally, totally. Like people saying, really? A lot.
Yeah. So that part of it will always remain.
I actually felt like the part when Midge walks in and goes, no cap, we need more milk. You know, I thought that was like, I'm going, where is that dialogue coming from, you know?
Mm-hmm. I think my favorite part of 402.
I need the sound effect where the joke goes over your head.
I know. I'm so sad.
You just
we
didn't laugh? That's the choice you made there?
Wait, say it again. Say it again. No, say it again.
I'm not doing this. Wait.
No. I'll be so good.
Okay.
Let's do it. Come on, please.
I can't believe I'm allowing you to do this. This is undignified. But you know the scene, and even the scene where Midge walks in and says, no cap, but I need milk for my kids.
Oh, that's really funny.
Oof. That was... I don't think deserved, but...
That's funny. No, that's funny.
Oof.
What?
Wow. You're the devil. Do you guys know that Kevin's the devil? I mean, you're Christian, but you're the devil, too. So it's like a fun...
They all liked it. Yes, so this episode continues to reset things, but Midge kind of goes in 402, her and Susie go to a club and kind of heckle a lot of the hacky male comics, and she does have a bizarre thing where she tries to get on stage and do their act, making fun of how hacky they are and how gendered the material is. She gets arrested for solicitation, but then Susie also bails out a sex worker or a dancer or whoever the case may be in the nightclub, and then she goes to a different nightclub and watches someone MC and do their jokes in between the ladies dancing, scantily clad, and perhaps an idea crosses her face.
Perhaps an idea, which I think is a good idea. If Midge wants to do this thing where she's, you know, I think maybe it's not as hateful as the rest of it, but the idea that she's like, so let's change the industry. Like, okay, that's, I can sink my teeth into that because the industry does need to change. It's 1960. Things are changing culturally. So obviously the way that entertainment is created needs to change. The formats need to change. There needs to be new venues for things that don't have venues now. I mean, that's always something that needs to occur. So the idea that Midge takes part in that is both somewhat believable and also a way that I could root for her again. You know, like, yeah, she's seen that there's like these trappings to, she puts her foot in her mouth too much when she's in these club settings because it doesn't really work with her persona. Like, she's not the kind of comedian that can do the things that normal comedians do. It's not where she thrives. So there's a better place for her. Like, she sees herself more on the Lenny Bruce track. And the thing about Lenny is that, like, he's always going to jail. So she's got to make a way for herself to be, he can always go to jail because he's got this wife to bail him out and he's a man, and that's, in a man's world, you can be Lenny Bruce, but you kind of can't be Lenny Bruce as a woman in 1960. So she's got to figure out what that path is. I guess I can wrap my head around that being a what is the word I keep forgetting? Like,
sympathetic. Okay.
Yeah. I want to say simpático because I'm fluent in Spanish, but it's sympathetic.
That's nice. I didn't know you were fluent in Spanish.
Well, you don't know a lot about me.
I know. I want to
know. And you'll never will.
I love you so much. No?
You got enough. I give so much. I'm a giver.
Someone I say I love you to just to say immediately, no. Not even thank you, which is, you know.
That's the purpose I fulfill in your life, though.
I love you. No.
What do people tune in for? I want to know. It's probably your takes on this show. They're definitely... I feel like I'm the Midge of this show. Like I bet the audience of this podcast is pretty equally divided on whether or not they hate me or love me. Like some people are like, I love Alice and her quips. And then some people are like, shut up.
Does this make me the Susie? Where like I'm widely agreed upon as like,
maybe,
you know, even when my story's not that good, you know, you still like me.
He's dependable. He's got good takes, you know?
Hey, don't worry about the quality of the takes.
People are not really sure about me, but they love my clothes.
I mean, before we get into the Twitter Q&A, anything we want to say about Joel and his continuing relationship with May and the mafia, perhaps, in Chinatown?
Yeah, that's tough because it's been so long since last season. I kind of forgot why I liked May so much because I did. I know I liked her.
Well, May rules. Stephanie Hsu, who plays her, I think is a tremendous actress. I find her so charming in every single thing I've ever seen her in, including this show.
Yes.
And I hope they give her a little more to chew on.
They could give her more to chew on.
She's the only woman of color with any recurring presence on the
show.
Well,
yeah,
too.
But also she came in hot, you know, when she came in, her character had a lot going for her and there was all this mystery surrounding there was a lot of intrigue with her character.
Yeah.
Like, what does she want? And now it kind of seems like she just wants to be Joel's girlfriend. And that's sort of like, it's kind of a bummer. You know, like we don't really care about that. Nobody really wants to be Joel's girlfriend.
Because the whole story with that is that he owns a nightclub and it's doing well, but it's doing too well. And May's maybe parents, maybe landlords of the operation.
Yeah.
Don't want it to.
And now it's
going to
become this like West Side Story situation that I'm like, that's not going to work. We can't have that.
Did you see the new West Side Story? Did you like it?
I didn't see it yet.
You didn't see it? Okay. I thought not it was yet. Really good. Well,
I don't like Tom Holland.
Tom Holland's not in West Side Story.
I know, but I can say I don't like Tom Holland whenever
you
I want.
You can, but I mean, I guess he's in Spider-Man, which is also Disney, like West Side Story is Disney.
You don't have to connect it. You don't even have to connect it.
Okay, well.
It's just, I know it might sound like it's a response to seeing West Side Story, but it doesn't have to be.
No, I don't like Tom Holland. You're just like abruptly changing the conversation.
Yeah, that's what it is.
I don't like Tom Holland.
Yeah, exactly. Do you want to go out for drinks sometimes? I don't like Tom Holland. Like we just went right past that question that you asked about drinks. And now we're going to talk about Tom Holland.
Alice, I think it's time once again for a little Twitter Q&A.
Tweet, tweet.
Remember that drop?
Oh, for sure.
And it's finally going to be relevant again because my love, my boo, my she's only coming. Woman, she is coming on the show. And that'll be thrilling for me. In one of her only roles since A Year in the Life. I think she did.
Really?
She was on the Ryan Murphy show Halston, starring Ewan McGregor, in like one or two episodes last year.
That's all she needs.
And she was good in it. But I wish she would work more.
I'm going to be selective about parts if I'm her and I got that syndicated TV show money.
Yeah, I mean, she's fine. Her husband died recently, though. She was much...
So, yeah.
What? Like, it's like party time is what you're saying? Let's go. She's just having people over.
That's not what I was saying. I was saying, like, so she's probably like... got good stuff going on. She doesn't personal stuff that makes her not able to work as much, but like you took it as it's like, yes, she's got to get fucking raw dogged. So she's got to get out there.
She's got,
wait,
I mean,
did her husband die? How did her husband die? Killed mysteriously by podcast host?
No, let's just say.
Wait a minute. Kevin, are you a person of interest?
He's sleeping with the podcast fishes right now. It's a specific podcast death that he has to die. No, of course. Thoughts and prayers to the whole family. I don't want to mock this man's death in any way.
It's found strangled by HDMI cords.
Yeah, it's like an XLR they found around his neck. Oh my God. No, he was very old. He was very old. Oh, before we get into the Twitter Q&A, one last thing. I thought the beat in 402 in which he saw that Shy Baldwin was engaged to a woman It was very nice because she sees on TV and then she goes in the room and cries. And it's kind of a little opaque, the reasons for which she's crying. Is it because she's on tour with him? Is it because she's sad for him that he has like doubled down on this sort of like lie of identity and this poor woman is going to enter into a marriage with a man who's probably not natively attracted to her? You know, I thought that was an interesting kind of nice beat.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. I mean, I took it as that she's just mad that she's not on tour with him. She's like, I know a thing, like it's all a lie, you know? And to me, if I were her, I'd go like, I'd be bitter. Like, oh, look, he's just moving on with the lie. And they're all, you know, and I was exposed to the dirty underbelly of, I guess, homosexuality. You know what I mean? Like, from that perspective, it's like, you know, he pretends to be a pretty, you know, straight guy, but actually he's a homosexual and I know it, type of thing. I don't know. I don't know how they're treating homosexuality, and I'm suspect.
Well, I'm really curious as to what Amy and Dan have to say about queer people, about trans people.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear it.
I can't wait till Amy kind of does a little jazz on BLM on someone's podcast in the next month or two.
Dan goes on one of those alpha male podcasts.
No, I was about to say Dan and Amy are going to go on Rogan and they're going to have a great time and become regulars on that show.
Let's hope, honestly. Anything would help Joe Rogan become better.
Twitter Q&A. So Jess says, I was a huge fan of the show. In the time since season 3 wrapped, I canceled my Prime subscription and stopped using Amazon altogether because I don't want to give monies to companies I disagree with. Is season 4 worth it to go back to the dark side? And I think our answer, Alice, has to be emphatically no. It's like, no, don't compromise for a season of a show. Although, here's...
My answer has to be... congrats.
Well, my answer has to be Nancy Pelosi clap emoji.
Nancy, like, it's like this, this tweet is like, hi, I'm a really good person.
Roasting them. They're so nice to give us a question and listen to our show.
And that's what I'm here for, baby. You don't write in just to get like featured on the show. You get written in to get roasted by me. And
well,
yeah,
that's going to be nice to Jess.
I'm going to say, Jess, call me when Lord of the Rings comes out because I want to know how you feel then. It's going to be real tough.
What am I going to do?
But yes, find ways to, what I do is to be a really good person is I don't buy stuff from Amazon, but I do have a Prime subscription. So I don't buy things. I'm still paying them. So I'm like only kind of a good person, but not a real good person.
Okay.
Like Jess.
I can dig that.
I don't think so. I don't think it's worth it. If you're already doing that and you finally liberated yourself from Amazon, no, I don't think so.
Well, here's something my friend Allison Herman is a big advocate of when it comes to, should I subscribe to this thing for this show? It's like, yeah, just cancel it. Subscribe for a month. Normalize subscribing to Showtime for 1 month to binge Yellow Jackets and then cancel it immediately. And then you just paid what? Like
$8.99. Yeah, I do tell people to do that. I do tell people to do that too. $8.99 for the whole season. Yeah.
Yeah, whatever.
Make some time, right, in your schedule so that when you can do it, when it's all out.
So when the whole thing's out in 5 weeks.
Exactly.
Buy 1 month of Amazon Prime and then cancel it.
Exactly. What will you lose out on? You'll lose out on the week-to-week experience that the show's supposed to be viewed in, and that's just not important enough.
And the discourse led by podcasts like this.
Yeah, but then you can listen to the podcast after. She's fine.
Fine or they're fine. We don't know. I'm not sure what gender Jess is. Ryan says,
sorry.
No, it's okay.
I'm making everybody me, like Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah, everyone kind of exists. Okay, so from now on, everyone's pronouns in our listener questions are
Alice.
Because it's Alice.
I kind of do that.
Okay, so Alice writes in with this next one, and Alice's name in this case is Ryan, and says, do you think the two Maisel kids ever get hugs? I don't know if their parents are either such a good parents, seem too loving, and even switch their birthdays for convenience. Esther or Ethan get a hug? And again, like the answer to my previous question, I think it's absolutely not. No, those kids are going to be such little sad weirdos.
Maybe like
weirdos.
A side hug. Right?
I think Abe probably bumps into them on the way to his office or whatever, his toilet office.
But what's her face that plays Joel's mom? She hugs them a lot. And she's the one nobody wants to be hugged by.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Oh, Joel's mom. Oh, Caroline Anderson. Yes.
Funnel Cake.
Funnel Cake. She's fucking funny. She's still fucking funny. As much as it can be like, you know. Or Caroline Aaron, not Anderson, excuse me. That's her name. And then another question we got from Chelsea is, does Midge know that her money, this is going to throw you for a loop, Alice, or trigger a memory in you. Chelsea/Alice says, does Midge know that her money problems could have been solved by her mom sucking up to her oil-rich Oklahoma relatives? Do you remember this at all from season 3?
Oh, my God.
It happened. It did happen.
Wow. That's crazy. I thought that feels like it's a different show. That feels like it's from like...
It was.
I Drink Your Milkshake. Or something.
It was from I Drink Your Milkshake, a weekly milkshake show taking place in Oklahoma in 1959.
Right? Isn't like, was so Paul funny? Dano in that episode? I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, I wish he was. Kinda. I like him. I used to not dislike him, and now I like him.
I don't like him.
You don't like him?
No, I don't like Tom Holland.
I actually don't like Tom Holland.
So
funny. Oh, hey, check this out. This podcast I listened to, one of the co-hosts said they don't like one of the most famous people alive right now. Oh. Mm. So funny.
I bet that person would go, is it Tom Holland?
How did she
know? I don't like him either.
In a lot of the rest of the questions, Alice, have to do with things that we've already covered. Avneet says, very general, but a common criticism of Maisel is the lack of focus on Miriam's career. I personally accepted that this is not a show about emerging comedian, but a family drama about changing dynamics in the late 50s, early 60s. What do you think? I think Avneet...
Really well said.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I would
better
say.
Better said than we said it.
yeah, for sure. Thanks for summing up.
And I think it is. Like, wouldn't it be incredible if in mid-season 4, the Paladins were like, I know we joked about it and her putting the apron onto a Barbra Streisand song, but if they were literally like, okay, she's not going to do stand-up anymore. She's going to figure something else out. And it's just about the families hanging out.
It's like, yeah, that's when Amy Sherman Palladino is in acceptance.
Yeah, that's what it would be.
Yeah, TFW, you find out that your whole podcast could have been a really good tweet.
TFW, when that tweet could have been a text, a group chat. Carrie asks also, please discuss the Paladino's obsession with close-up magic, which we did. Predict where the hell they're going with the trippy card trick. Again, I do hope it gets a little goofy.
Oh, please, God, bring it back. Yeah, right?
Bring back that weirdo.
Bring back that Umbrella Academy motherfucker.
And then bonus question. I don't know if you have one, Alice.
Ooh, a bonus.
Share a personal experience with being accosted by a magician. Do we have any experiences being accosted by magicians?
Well, we live in Los Angeles, so for me, the relationship with magicians in Los Angeles, at least, is reversed because we have something called the Magic Castle.
The Magic Castle.
Which is this super exclusive magic club that you have to know somebody to get into to hang out with the close-up magicians. So, like, our relationship with close-up magicians where we live is completely the opposite of what it is in the rest of society. We're like, we have to like actively find somebody to help us seek out the company of close-up magicians. And it's like really this like sought after exclusive experience. Whereas in like Idaho or wherever you live, like Salt Lake City, they'll just come up to you and you're just like, get away. So that's crazy.
So there is an epidemic of close-up magicians that have taken over both Idaho and Salt Lake City. I'm so glad that Alice
That's where they're centralized. That's where they originate.
And us talking about on this podcast is giving a voice to the voiceless, finally.
Yeah.
After all this.
Yeah, and it's like, are we platforming them or are we giving light to the struggle of people that are trying to eradicate this place?
What do you think, listeners? Sound off in the comments. Are we platforming magicians? Are we trying to speak truth to power? And then I'll make this our last question, Alice. This one comes to us from Alice/Brett. They say, Maylin is probably my favorite character on the show. But I know she's on borrowed time because she's not main cast and is dating Mrs. Maisel's ex, parentheses, soon to be not ex-husband. How do you think she'll be written out?
I mean, I don't like that. I don't like thinking about that because we haven't barely given her. I always feel like I want more May.
Now, this would be, again, I just want to keep.
How did they write out Logan? Or
they didn't.
They didn't. They
because once
in.
He was on the whole show until he proposed to Rory at her graduation.
So that's what they're going to do. They're going to keep her around. It's cruel. It's cruel what they'll do.
Yeah.
And she'll be like there all of a sudden. And you're like, she's been here the whole time?
Or let's keep going with our original idea. Mid-season four, Midge decides, you know what? I don't want to do stand-up anymore. Brisket all the time, baby. And,
brisket all the way.
And it's brisket all the way. She opens up a brisket pop-up in Brooklyn or Williamsburg or whatever the fuck. The 1960s version of a pop-up.
Yeah.
May is like, you know what? I might give this a shot because Midge bails on a set that she was supposed to do at Joel's club. And then Joel's like, oh my God, May, I don't know what to do. And she's like, I'll take care of it. And she goes up, fucking crushes it. It's the first funny stand-up we've ever seen on the show. And we love it. And then it becomes Whoa. The marvelous May. And it's just that's it.
Or she gets the marvelous May.
Just the marvelous
May. And like
May.
A dash after it. Like,
yeah.
Or, how about this? She gets trapped in the close-up magician's netherworld.
That's exactly, Alice, that was my second thought that I had.
Really?
It's like she gets trapped in a calendar. Yes, of course. Yeah, like it's literally, what's her name in season two of Twin Peaks? It gets trapped in the doorknob. Do you remember that?
Oof. I do sort of remember that.
That's a deep hole. Wow. Well, I think we did it.
I do have one call-in question that's been, somebody's been waiting.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so this is amazing. We actually have a call-in, and it's incredible that we have a listener calling in because we didn't even tweet out the number. But we have a call-in question now. So, hey there, what's your name and where are you calling from?
Hi, my name is Mara. I'm calling from Idaho.
What was your name? I didn't quite get that. Hoover?
Yes. I just wanted to know, who paid for Joel and Penny's apartment? Did they move in together and Joel was paying for most of it? Or was she already living there? I thought Joel was broke, so how did you go get a fully furnished apartment? Do you remember that?
I think Joel's not broke.
I'll take my question off the air.
Okay, wow. Okay, thank you to Hoover from Idaho. I think that was their name. I'm not sure.
I think it was Murr.
It was Murr? Oh, excuse me, Murr from Idaho.
Murr. Murr person.
Murr from Idaho. That was a gorgeously articulated question.
So I thought it was Penny's apartment.
Penny Pans?
And Joel moved in with her. Penny Pan?
No, Joel's living above, like...
Remember?
I thought he was living in the office. No, I don't remember.
No. This is back in season one. Murr's talking about season one. Remember how Joel was broke and then he just like had a new fully furnished apartment with Penny Pan?
I don't remember that.
Oh,
I vaguely
remember
Murr,
you stumped Kevin yet again. We'll see what happens next week on The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel-Goyes if you call in again
Mrs.
and stump Kevin.
What's up, everybody? Rate and subscribe in the link below. Sound off in the comments.
Tell your friends. Tell your dad's friends.
And tell my dad, because he doesn't care.
Tell your dad's friends. Maybe one of your dad's friends knows my dad. Jesus Christ in your heart.
Oh, you're saying my dad is Jesus Christ?
I don't like Tom Holland.
That was a hard Holocaust joke that they made in 401, in which they said, when you go to Prague, say you love Jesus Christ a lot. The idea
I liked
being,
that.
It was.
I liked that a lot.
It was kind of excellent, right? Just say you
I
love
liked it
Jesus.
A lot more than the Holocaust joke.
Okay. Well, on that note, this has been The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel-Goyes. Alice, where can people find you? What do you have to...
Twitter. My show, The Resident Alien, not The Resident Alien, don't know why I said that. It airs every Wednesday on Sci-Fi at 8, 9 Central, and the next day on Peacock.
The Resident Alien, starring Matt Zuckery.
And, it's everybody... The Resident... I have watched that. I've tried to watch
that,
it.
I think it's been like season 9 and he's like, you know, going to be working for the rest of his
Yeah, you can pretty much
life.
Tune in wherever with that show. But the show's in, we're airing episode 5 tonight. So by the time this comes out, it'll be probably 6 or 7 is out. And 8, the finale, mini finale is coming up. So that'll be fun to watch. I really highly recommend my show. I think it's great. I have not been doing any stand-up because they won't allow it with COVID, but hopefully I'll be done in April or be able to go back out on the road at some point.
Lovely.
COVID depending.
Well, you can follow me at Kevin T. Porter on Peloton, Letterboxd, and OnlyFans. I'm up to 17 fans on OnlyFans now, trying to get the word out, and it's going really well. We're really building quite
a community.
I thought
you would be on mostly fans. Where it's like, yeah, people like you, but there's a couple haters in there.
Yeah, like
that are still paying you.
They think it's fine. They think it's good-ish.
Yeah.
But it's hit and miss, so it's mostly fans.
Yeah.
Yes. Wait, can I plug a dumb thing I've been doing? Am I allowed, mm-hmm. Alice?
Yeah.
You know how in every TV show and movie, whenever they show a picture of the family together at an earlier time, it's the worst Photoshop you've ever seen in your life? Whenever it's like a framed photo. Well, I started an account of sorts to catalog all of those times. It's called Sloppy Photoshoppy at Slop Photoshop. And every week I'm just posting screenshots of the parts in TV shows and movies in which it's the ugliest Photoshopped picture of an old family or whatever the case may be that you've ever seen. So you can give it a follow at Slop Photoshop. And then listen to good Christian fun wherever you get your podcast.
Dumb plug.
Why is it dumb? I'm sorry.
It's a dumb plug. I'm trying to use my pedal. There we go. Dumb plug. It's time for a dumb plug. Okay, sorry.
Alice, I'm so glad we're back at it again.
What? Me too. What too?
I said, Alice, I'm so glad
we're
back.
Oh, me too. I love you too, Kevin. Okay?
I didn't say I love you.
I do though, so it's fine.
Okay, well, I love you. I'm glad we're going to be doing at least three more episodes. We could do three more and we do two per ep. You want to keep doing that? Does that sound fun?
Sound off in the comments.
Well, we're going to have to figure it out before we record next time.
No, sound off in the comments to tell us what you want us to do. After the fact, we will have already chosen at that point, but still,
yeah,
sound
but
off in the comments.
Sound off in the comments for the illusion of a conversation happening between listeners.
Yeah, yeah. Well, isn't that always what it is?
No, sometimes I really try to take that stuff to. Is that what I sound like to you? Remember when I said it was going to be 90 minutes
Kevin,
top?
Can I speak to you for a second?
Yeah. What's up?
Oh my God, you're right. I got to go. I love you.
I love you too. Okay, let's go out with the song that ends episode 402 when Tony Shalhoub and Midge Maisel are talking about art. It's a song called Art for Art's Sake by 10cc.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.